Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and yes, this is the last show for the year. After today, I'm going to take a nice long break, actually, returning on January 10 with a new season, the 12th season of Risky Business. Holy God. So we got a fantastic episode for you this week. In this week's feature, Stephen Moore joins us. He was formerly the Staff Vice President of Cybersecurity Analytics at Anthem, the healthcare company that was spectacularly owned back in 2015. But instead of us all just saying, you know, lol, they got owned, they must be idiots, I thought it might be an idea to actually talk to someone who was there. As you'll hear, they knew they were being targeted well before the breach happened. They did their best to fend off the attackers, but they lost anyway. It is sobering listening, and I think, there's a few lessons to be learned in that one, so stick around for that. This week's sponsor interview is also, really just great. We'll be checking in with Casey Ellis of BugCrowd. He'll be along to talk about this whole Uber mess. A lot of the reporting around the so-called Uber data breach seemed to fixate a bit on the fact that the attacker was paid via the HackerOne bug bounty platform. And that coverage has sort of conflated extortion with bug bounties, much to Casey's dismay. He'll be along a little bit later on to share his views on what the Uber snafu means for his industry, as well as to share his thoughts on DJI's disastrous bug bounty program. That's all coming up later, but before all of that, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news for the last time this year. And Adam, what a great headline to lead with. Apparently, there's a list of 1.4 billion clear text CRED pairs floating around in a single database. And that database, you know, it's not just a giant flat file. This is actually a fairly organized database.
Yeah, we've seen someone aggregate a whole bunch of previous breaches. There's no suggestion here, I think, that there's any new breaches in this data set. But yeah, it's an aggregation of some of the previous ones. It's been doing the rounds in the usual sorts of places. Much has been made, I guess, of the size of 1.4 billion sets of credentials in the clear, which, yeah, it's quite a useful thing if you're an attacker. Some of the credentials are pretty old, and some of the breaches go back to the, you know, a decade or more. So some of those accounts are not much use anymore. But it is a collection of things. And yeah, people have been enjoying the fact that the way that it's structured lets you kind of query it quite easily with a shell script. Although if you want to do a query other than just email address, then it doesn't work so well. It's been doing the rounds. Some of the reporting around it has been rather breathy, which... I don't know.
Let's just put that into context. I think Have I Been Pwned has something like, they're approaching 5 billion records, right? But they don't let you look up hashes. I guess that's the difference. Or actual cracked passwords. So I think that's the difference here, isn't it? It's not about the idea that the information is new. It's that it's actually quite easy to access and use.
Yeah, and I guess for people perhaps on the defensive side, that might be surprising how easy it is to get this data. And obviously for attackers, people have been trading stolen passwords in the underground for forever. It's probably, the bad guys already had this stuff and had it for a long time. And now I guess it's useful for people to see what this actually looks like rather than, hidden behind an interface like Have I Been Pwned, where you don't get to use the data for what you need. So, being able to see, for example, where people reuse passwords across things for your user base actually can be quite a useful insight that you can't, necessarily easily get from other sources. So, yeah, it's worth it. It's worth a look.
Now, we've seen a couple of reports this week that are really honing in on Iran getting a little bit more active APT-wise. Is this sort of research and this reporting convincing to you, Adam? Because I have been hearing just murmurs that Iran really is sort of kicking things up a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the stories seem to be reporting that there has been a fairly significant uptick in activity for groups that are, tied to Iran, attributed to Iran in the last year or so. A lot of this does seem to be centered around other states in the Middle East rather than necessarily US. Obviously, there's some activity in the US. But yeah, I mean, in particular, I think the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which, obviously there's been some historical hacking there, Saudi Arabia being the one that immediately comes to mind, but it's far from the only one. But what we are seeing is that the groups that are involved with some of those previous campaigns have been stepping up activity, and in particular against critical infrastructure other kind of useful political targets in the Middle East and in the US. And obviously the concern is that, you know, if they can do it there, they can also do it in the US, and the relationship politically is not not amazing. But yeah, in particular, the groups APT 33 and 34 are the ones that have been talked about mostly. The other names for those include Charming Kitten and Rocket Kitten. I can only hope that that's a, you know, Persia purring joke or something. They've been kind of mostly attributed to the Iranians, although the kind of way that they structure the actors that operate on behalf of the Iranian government, i.e., you know, maybe private citizens, you know, kind of doing work for the government on the side of either hacking or, you know, that is contractors rather than necessarily government employees. But yeah, most of those, the activity of those groups does seem to be fairly firmly attributed these days. Mm. Another piece of activity attributed to Iran in this reporting is the compromise of Deloitte. Last year, they had some database in Azure compromised. Apparently, people are saying that that also was Iran. So exactly what they're doing up in Deloitte remains to be seen, but interesting, I am sure.
Yeah, it's funny that we're talking about this because in this week's feature, you know, you're going to hear someone who was at Anthem who was raising the alarm saying, hey, you know, we've got some, we've just found some Chinese APT malware in the network. You know, maybe we should be a bit worried about that. And it's a little bit difficult to raise the alarm because there is this attitude of like, well, you know, why would anyone want to attack us? And I'm sure, you know, maybe some similar thinking at Deloitte there. And it's interesting, right, because there's a lot going on in the Middle East at the moment. I mean, some people are seeing that the US might have a little bit less influence there because maybe it's not taken quite as seriously in the Middle East these days. So there's, you know, there's all sorts of power dynamics shifting over there. So I'm not surprised to see an uptick in this sort of activity. Speaking of all things spooky, this Kevin Paulson was tweeting about this earlier. I hijacked it off his Twitter, but yeah, a whole bunch of traffic to some pretty high profile organizations like Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, Twitch, NTT and Riot Games apparently got BGP hijacked and routed through Russia for a little while. That's interesting.
Yeah, apparently it's an AS out of Russia that hasn't been used for much in a couple of years and then all of a sudden started advertising bits of Google and Apple, etc. So yeah, that's, yeah, not super great. It's not clear exactly what it was for. It was only for a few minutes each time. But yeah, that's, you know, I guess if you're a network operator, that's a thing that probably you should be a little bit worried about.
Shifting our attention now to Italy, and apparently the prosecutor behind this, you know, hacking team investigation is looking to wrap the whole thing up after 2 years.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like the investigation has gotten particularly far, and the prosecutor is kind of over it and wants to wrap up the rest of the investigation, having found nothing. So, yeah, I guess old mate Phineas, his OPSEC was pretty good, it seems.
Now Australia has just introduced pretty quietly some new laws that I think are quite interesting, right? So these laws are squarely aimed at organizations like WikiLeaks and people like Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning. I'm kind of in two minds with this one because what they've done is they've introduced this very serious offense where if you leak like more than five classified documents, then you're in all of a sudden a whole lot of trouble, right? So it does seem squarely aimed at people who are trying to take large caches of documents. That's what it seems like the laws are aimed at. But then again, I mean, there's some people are naturally quite concerned that this law could criminalize legitimate whistleblowing. It's a concern I share, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, obviously in your line of work, it's particularly important, you know, that if you are, you know, handling anonymous sources that are giving you interesting data, that, you know, you don't want to end up 20 years in jail for doing, you know, doing what is your legitimate job and may well be legitimate public interest. And
but at the same time, I'm not sure that I need more than five code word classified top secret documents to be able to tell a story, right?
Yeah, so, mind you. Yeah, I mean, I think though some of the stories we saw coming out of the Snowden docs really did take a bunch of different documents to kind of contextualize to understand what was going on. So, I mean, the numbers seem kind of arbitrary, but I mean, that was
okay. So, what were the public interest stories that required multiple documents there? Because there were certainly documents that filled in the gap, and it was great for nerds like you and me to be able to talk about them. But, you know, for me, the blockbuster was certainly the rolling FISA warrants for the phone metadata. I mean, that was the high impact story there, and that was based off a single document.
Yeah, no, I mean, you make a point, right? I mean, there wasn't a whole load of public interest stuff other than, you know, making us feel less paranoid and, you know, more grounded in reality. But, yeah, no, you're right. And obviously there's always this kind of tension between what's legit public interest reporting and good journalism and what's, you know, just spraying state secrets around the internet willy-nilly, you know, yeah, for whatever reasons.
Yeah, that's right. And look, I think one thing that the thing that really worries me, right, is here we've got some very controversial immigration policies, and the government has sort of wrapped those policies into this whole, they've sort of conflated it with national security, right? We've got this whole border protection agency that mostly just sends brown people into horrible camps in the Pacific if they try to come to Australia by boat. And the government does have a habit of routinely overclassifying material relating to those programs, right? So, you know, I can understand why people would suggest that these laws are sort of aimed at that, but it does really, it doesn't have that feel to me. And I guess, I really guess we're just going to have to wait and see if one of these goes to court, and a lot of this is going to be up to the courts, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess, well, yeah, we will have to wait and see. Obviously, the implementation of it is what matters, and, you know, it may not even make it through the legislative process in its current form. But, yeah, overall, it just, you know, it illustrates the complexity of, you know, of handling this kind of data and of telling the stories of what our governments do in our name, you know, which...
Yeah, which are, you know, they're important stories. They absolutely yeah, they are. So, you know, we'll be keeping an eye on that one. But they tried sneaky-sneakying that one, and it was a BuzzFeed reporter, Paul Farrell, who caught that. So well done to him. Some interesting stuff coming out of the UK Electoral Commission's investigation into Russian interference on Brexit. We've seen some numbers sort of cough out of that inquiry. Twitter now says that it removes 3.2 million accounts every week, which I think is just amazing.
Yeah, that's got to be a pretty thankless job, having to go to work and, you know, RM bot accounts all day, every day. Yeah, but that's, there was something, what was it, 5% of accounts they reckon are currently bots, which...
Seems a little on the low side to me.
It does seem a little low to me, but, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm in a, you know, high bot constituency area of the, you know, corner of the Twitters or something.
Now, look, surprisingly, this was a pretty slow news week. So I thought we could actually tackle an issue that people have been talking a lot about over the last couple of weeks. I mean, they've been talking about it for, you know, 10 years, 10 plus years. But this whole thing around extended validation certificates is really topical at the moment. We've seen serious discussion from browser makers about maybe, you know, floating the idea of dumping EV. To me, that seems a little bit crazy, right? It just seems like everyone's very anti-CA at the moment. And I get it. I mean, we've been saying for years on this show what a crap job they do. But I sort of feel like we're at risk of throwing the baby out with the bathwater on this. Adam, what do you think?
I think, yeah, it's clearly a conversation that has reached a peak at the moment. There's been a couple of stories where people have obtained, you know, valid EV certs that are, you know, confusing to the user. You know, we saw one guy from the UK, I think, getting a certificate for Identity Verified was the name of the company that he registered and then got an EV cert for. We saw somebody else register a company called Stripe in a different state in the US than the real Stripe. And, you know, obviously to the browser, they are both just as good as each other for EV certs. And it looks bad in the interface for a confused user. And I think other than the case of Safari and Apple Safari, it actually replaces the entire URL bar with the name of the company from the EV cert. Like, that's a terrible UI choice, and Apple should just stop doing that. And I'm sure they will, because it's dumb. But yeah, overall, I mean, I guess it illustrates the difference between what people expect of their browser and of certification and identity verification and what it actually technically does.
This is the thing, right? We've conflated. We've spent, you know, decades conflating secure network connections with identity verification, right? Users don't know the difference. And people say, well, that means that EV is pointless. I don't agree with that. I just think that we need to maybe do a better job on the interface side of things. I would have thought green for EV, yellow for domain validated certs, and red for clear kind of makes sense, right? I mean, the big criticism of extended validation is it requires users to understand too much. And that's the browser's fault. That's not the certificate's fault. And I think we need to direct our criticism at the people who are making these shitty interfaces.
Yeah, and I think that is a fair thing. Like, the point of EV certificates and what they're meant to do, they are basically doing, right? Which is tying the digital certificates to an actual corporate entity in some other registry, you know, a company registry in a state or a country or whatever. And the problem is, and I think, as you correctly point out, it's fundamentally a user interface kind of thing, because, I mean, we don't convey to the users what they should expect from this. And there's actually a really robust discussion on one of the Mozilla dev security policy lists kind of about what they are doing through the UI. And I think the other browser vendors, obviously Chrome and Safari and stuff, will also be having similar conversations, you know, about exactly whether or not they should devote space to EV, you know, user interface spackle space to EV certs, and if so, what it should say. One of the big criticisms, I think, and in the case of the Stripe example, is that company names aren't globally unique, right? And people may have an expectation when they see Stripe that it's one particular company that they think.
I think we're overthinking that to a degree. I mean, I even remember when OV certs, organizational, you know, validated certs, you required a Dun & Bradstreet report to be sort of faxed or whatever it was back in those days when I was wearing an onion on my belt because that was the style at the time. I think really what we need to do is get serious about setting some standards for EV, but most of them do require, you know, you'd sort of need to forge a couple of documents, I would think. I don't know, because I haven't applied for one recently. But I would think with a lot of CAs, you need to show them a bunch of documents. Okay, sure, you can forge them, but you're paying a lot of money and it makes it a lot harder, right? I mean, it's not perfect, but it helps, right? So I guess I agree with the problems that people are pointing out. They are problems, but I don't think the solution is just to say, oh, let's just completely throw out this imperfect thing. I think the solution might be to say, hey, you know, you guys keep writing out dodgy EV certs, so we're going to remove you from our browser stack. Like, bye-bye.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's the bad CA side of things. I think we all agree that they should get thrown out of the browsers when CAs misbehave. And certificate transparency obviously helps police some of that. But yeah, I think in the case of EV certs, I think the best solution here is to expose the reality of what they are to the users, i.e. that it says that this certificate is issued to a particular company in this jurisdiction. The certificate contains that data. It's just not surfaced in the UI because it's kind of ugly. Like, some browsers will show you the country. But my biggest beef is that
we're still showing DV certs. The marking on Chrome says secure in green. That's ridiculous because it confuses. I mean, I don't think, you know, that users can make the distinction that just means they're encrypted to that domain. They think that it's a mark of authenticity or validation. It's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the whole how do you tell who you're talking to is way beyond just EV cert. And yeah, you're right. I mean, the understanding of the technical implementation of a certificate and a URL and what those mean and how they're visible to the user in the browser is a problem that, you know, I guess if we were going to solve, we probably would have solved it by now. Clearly it's pretty hard because we've been screwing it up for decades. But
I think Matt Tate came up with a couple of really interesting ideas where he said, you know, a good solution for this down the track is going to be, domain lookups, right, from your browser, which can actually do something out of band and go, well, is this a good domain or is this a bad domain? So forget about, you know, using CAs in the mix. And I think that's a great destination to arrive at, but we're not there yet. And now people are talking about abandoning EV, and it's just, I think it will be chaos for a lot of people, users and organizations who have their users being fished, right? So I just think everyone needs to calm down a little bit, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem strictly necessary to throw out the entire EV mechanism because it can be circumvented by registering a company for $40, which, I mean, clearly people were already spending money to get certificates before they became free as well. So, I don't know. I mean, obviously we need an ecosystem as a whole that is resilient against, you know, the wider range of attacks and techniques and not just forging identity of websites. I mean, you know, two-factor auth, for example, that is tied to the real identity of the site. I'm thinking like U2F tokens. Like, that's the thing where it kind of doesn't matter that you're ending up at a site that doesn't match what you, the human, thinks, because your authentication token won't hand out your creds because it can tell the difference. So, I mean, as an ecosystem, there are things that we can do, but obviously fixing just SSL and people's perception of what padlocks mean, as Peter Goodman says, that's a wicked problem.
Yep. Well, luckily we solved it in the last episode for the year. Good job, Adam. Good job. Good job. On to the next story. Ars Technica. And I saw Jake Davis on Twitter last night, you know, noting that this crew that took $10 million from an ATM network has been dubbed Money Taker. And Jake has determined that they have been called Money Taker because they take money. Good. That's some nice threat actor naming there, whoever named them. Like, Money
truly
Taker.
Insightful stuff.
Yes, there you go. Tell us about Money Taker. Do they take money?
So apparently Money Taker have been going after a bunch of like non-Swift funds transfer networks between banks and then using that to cash out a bunch of money. They've hacked, I think, a couple of dozen banks now with a take of something like $80 million. Their methodology, surprising no one, appears to be something like, fish a user, gain some degree of access, get domain admin, and then proceed to steal money. So yeah, that's truly also surprising. They use regular tools like Metasploit and PowerShell and go about hacking business like regular hackers. You'd think maybe they'd make more money stealing Bitcoin, but hey, $80 million, not too bad. Money taking by money takers.
Better than a kick in the face, you would think. Joseph Cox, reporting for the Daily Beast, wrote a nice little story on how people are sort of laundering Bitcoins through iTunes gift cards.
Yeah, this is quite a smart process, actually. It goes like this. So say you have a whole bunch of Bitcoins and you'd like to get dollars. And apparently it goes like this. You, step one, make some music that doesn't suck. And then you get it published on iTunes. There's a number of places where you can do that. You can make your own CDs and kind of self-publish your music on the iTunes music store. Then you obtain iTunes gift cards for Bitcoins through whatever medium you can do so. And then you buy your own music and Apple sends you a check for the dollars. Well, that seems straightforward.
Yeah, yeah, nice nice going there. So, yeah, happy days. Ian Beer over at Project Zero, dumping some pretty good old iOS research on the internets there, eh, Adam?
Yeah, pretty much looks like, the first and most important part of a jailbreak for iOS 11.1.2, which, of course, is the second most recent release now, that was published on the Project Zero bug tracker. It provides a mechanism for people to go and shell their iOS. Apparently Google are quite happy publishing the details because I think people are going to go and be able to do their own research and find more bugs in iOS and get them patched. And, you know, yeah, that seems pretty legit to me. I'm happy with that. So thank you, Google, for making Apple's products better for us.
Yes. There you go. Staying with mobile, there is apparently a nasty Android flaw going around. Colour me surprised.
Yeah, perhaps Google could make their own mobile operating system better too. Apparently there's some bug where you could like modify an APK such that it was still valid under its signature, even though it now had different code in it. And basically it uses the confusion between what an APK file is and what a the actual kind of like DEX jar archives are, and kind of loose parsing in the way that those are validated, which is actually a pretty, you know, pretty sweet bug, really. But yeah, just kind of boneheaded, unfortunately. And yeah, if apparently it's Android 7 and prior are vulnerable to this kind of thing. So if you're loading apps from app stores other than the Google Play Store, then yeah, going to have a bad time.
Well, you're going to have a bad time anyway, right?
So. Well, you're going to have a bad time anyway. Yes, that's right.
Yes, yes. Now, we actually had a skateboarding dog request this week from none other than Tim Watts, who is a member of parliament here in Australia, member of the federal parliament. He writes, "Hey, Risky Business, can the Australian political figure single tweet hacker be this week's skateboarding dog?" And you know what, Tim? We will grant you your request. We have seen a spate, Adam, of terrible attacks here in Australia. There is a very advanced attacker. And what they do is they keep hacking Australian politicians' Twitter accounts and then like liking something embarrassing just once. And that's all they do. And apparently there is a spate of them. We saw some time ago. We've seen these poor politicians. One of them was Christopher Pyne, whose account was used to like a pornographic tweet. Then there was the health minister, Greg Hunt, also liked a pornographic tweet. Both times this was hackers, which is amazing. And then we also saw the Australian ambassador to the United States, Joe Hockey, also liked a tweet that referred to our Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull as a, quote, cranky prick. So apparently that was a hacker who did that as well. So there is someone out there, you know, just causing all manner of chaos, and it totally is a hacker and not just people fat fingering the like button on tweets at all.
Yeah. I raise my hoodie to Phineas Fisher too, who is in there, you know, putting truth into Australian politics with that like button. Good on you, sir. Good on you.
But it does occur to me, Adam, and this is the crazy thing, right? Now, if you were gonna cause a bit of mischief, that's exactly what you'd do. Because you know that if you owned an account, just liked a single embarrassing tweet, and then that person says that they got hacked, you know that no one's going to believe them, right? So there's a part of me that thinks this actually could be for real. Could be for real.
Maybe. That smart like a fox there. Maybe it's you, Pat. Maybe you're doing it.
Well, mate, that's actually it for the year's news, man. It's been a hell of a ride, 2017.
Yeah, we've had a lot of good stuff go horribly wrong this year, which, you know, always warms the cockles of my black heart. We'll wait and see what happens while you're on holiday, though, because, I mean, like, what do we even follow up
this
year's disaster?
That usually sends things into hyperdrive. The first show back is always an interesting one. But, look, it certainly does feel, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this, it certainly does feel like this year it's been hard to keep up, you know, and it's my full-time job to keep up with what's happening in InfoSec, and I've found it hard as my full-time job. Have you experienced that as well?
Yeah, and I think the thing I find difficult is keeping track of the interaction of all of the security aspects with everything else now. Like, it used to be back, you know, 5 years ago, we'd cover, you know, Oracle bugs, and we'd have a chortle about, you know, them and computer associates or whatever. And now it's, the, you know, like the interaction of security with geopolitics and, you know, with commerce and just all of the other ways that security ties into everything requires so much more context. And I find that that's hard to keep up with and to make sure that we are, you know, when we're talking about, you know, things going on in Iran, that we do understand, you know, the hows and the whys, as well as just the technical aspects.
No one understands the hows and the whys of Middle Eastern politics, dude. No, come on, right. That's setting the bar a little bit too high for this show, I think. But I get your point. It's just it is much more ingrained, isn't it? Like, it's we've been dealing with APTs and espionage and whatever, but now it seems like it's moved up that sort of power structure a bit. And now that these campaigns are quite strategic and directed by higher levels of government, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, you know, and the way that it's accelerated into a tool, you know, the cybers have become a tool of, you know, so many people rather than just, you know, the historical, you know, US and Russia and Israel and the rest of the Five Eyes and that kind of thing. Like, to, you know, everyone's doing it these days because it's cheap and it works well, and you can get the job done. Like, whether it's Kim Jong-un taking out Sony or banks in South Korea or, you know, Iranians taking out Aramco. I mean, it's just, you know, we're seeing so many avenues that these tools are being used for and techniques are being used for. And yeah, it is hard to keep track with. I mean, obviously the technical aspects of everything are a constant treadmill, but then, you know, what they all mean, how they work together. And I mean, I can't even imagine how we're going to do security. I mean, like, even in my line of work, how we're going to do security assurance in a world that's built out of cloud stuff that we can't see the insides of. I mean, that's, you know, terrifies me what we're going to have to deal with next year, you know, with all the systems that we've been, you know, spent the last couple of years as an industry building. So let alone the technical side of things, plus everything else. So yeah, no, it really has been a, you know, quite a challenging year. I think,
I'm just before we push off, I've got to tell you something that'll freak you out a little, which is the Saudi Aramco attacks were actually 5 years and 4 months ago, my friend.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it seems so recent that, you know, Stuxnet broke. And we got our first kind of insight.
That was 2010. That was 2010. And, you know, I'm looking at something like and I look back at things like Aramco, I look back at things like Stuxnet, and I think, oh, how quaint when it was that simple. When it was as simple as being a destructive attack, or whether it was, you know, maybe some of these Chinese APT campaigns that were designed to get information. We knew what they were doing. We don't know what they're doing anymore. Even though they're doing it openly, it's really hard to divine the agenda. And I think that's something that's changed and makes us all feel a little bit confused.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Eh? And we really haven't seen how this stuff is going to start to interact with, like, real supply chain. I mean, that's the
next cab off the rank, man. Yeah, for sure.
You reckon next year we'll deal with that one?
I think it's already happening. We just don't know about it yet, you know?
Well, yeah, that's it, right? Like, how many years was Stuxnet, you know, doing its thing before we got to know about it? And now we're going to have to deal with, you know, what does GitHub look like as a security threat to us all? Like, how many GitHub repos does your company rely on, and any one of them getting owned gets code exec in the middle of your network? Like, answering questions like that is really, really difficult. But for an attacker,
that's
quite an appealing sort of thing to go
to. Especially when it's some library that's way upstream, right?
Well, yeah, exactly, right? And it used to be everyone was like, oh, it would be fun to go own kernel.org and backdoor the kernel, right? But, I mean, there's so much other stuff in the supply chain, software wise as well as hardware, that we're going to see. I mean,
yeah, I'm guessing some of that's going to shake out next year. But look, let's wrap it up there, Adam. Thank you so much for all of your contributions over the year. It's been a real pleasure to work with you. And yeah, mate, we'll pick it up again in January.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's nice to have a few weeks off and, you know, to do things other than computers for a bit. But yeah, come January, we can talk about all the terrible things that have happened, and won't it be great?
Look at the forest. Forget about computers. That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news, and he'll be back in 2018 with more security news goodness. On to this week's announcements now, and we just have one. Airlock Digital, the Australian firm that makes an application whitelisting product, has just released a new version, and they want to announce that. The big change in this release is they've partnered with Reversing Labs, so you can now do reputation lookups on files when you're making decisions about whether or not to add them to your whitelist, which is, very, very handy in a whitelisting product. So if you're a customer, you'll probably want to upgrade to their newest version. So go to airlockdigital.com for info on that. Airlockdigital.com. And that's it for announcements this week. If you want to run an announcement in this section, you can contact sales@risky.biz. Now, a bit of housekeeping before we proceed. Last week, I had Dino Dizovi onto risky.biz in a Snake Oilers podcast. He was talking about his new business and product, Capsule 8. During that interview, he mentioned that unlike OS Query, Capsule 8 does things in real time. And boy, oh boy, did that piss off the proponents of OS Query. They say Dino's missing a couple of points. And I got to say, I do see where they're coming from, but I don't think Dino was dumping as hard on OS Query as badly as they think he was. But anyway, the whole thing turned into a pretty interesting Twitter thread, and I've linked through to that in this week's show notes. So you can dive on in and have a read of that if you so wish. Now, it is time for this week's feature interview now, and I honestly think this is one of the best interviews I've ever run on this program, mostly because it's genuinely rare to find people to talk about this sort of stuff. Most people just aren't prepared to do it. From November 2009 to March 2017, Stephen Moore, our guest this week, worked in security for Anthem, the healthcare company. And spoiler alert, they got owned pretty hard in 2015 by a Chinese APT crew. In all, 78.8 million records were stolen from the company, according to the high side estimates. I think the low side estimate when it first broke was something like 37 million or something like that, but other reporting says 78.8 million. So yeah, it was bad news all around for Anthem. In June this year, the company settled a class action lawsuit for $115 million. Stephen Moore had acted as the company's expert witness during the class action, and shortly after it all wrapped up, he left the company. He's picked up a gig with Exabeam. He joined them in August this year, and he's currently working as VP and Chief Security Strategist for Exabeam. Now, as some of you would know, Exabeam is a sponsor of this show, and the reason this interview came about is I was having a conversation with one of the founders who just suggested that I speak to Stephen about this, and obviously I jumped at it. But this is not a sponsored interview, though. Just so you all know, this is very much a regular feature segment. Now, at the time of the breach, Stephen was Anthem's Senior Director of Information Security, Cybersecurity Operations, and by the time he left, he was Staff Vice President of Cybersecurity Analytics. He joined me via Skype to walk us through the whole mess, and I started off by asking him simply how the breach went down. Here's what he said.
My very small team of six or seven people that was really an additional sort of investment in security on top of all the other teams and people was tasked with understanding possible adversaries and sort of doing more with what we had. And, you know, 5 or 6 months prior to the breach, we sort of identified that there may be interests from nation states in the interest of Anthem. And so we began working on that problem set and attempting to work more on that adversary, meaning understanding their potential motives and then sharing that with the larger organization. So that was sort of a pre-event, if you will. And you probably have questions, so I'll stop there.
Yeah, so I mean, already you were onto the idea that something was coming down the line. I mean, how did you become aware of that?
With a great team, starting with wonderful people that had a passion for understanding these things. We started seeing interest in some of our computing environments, some behaviors that looked interesting, even
recon,
some phishing.
Recon sort of stuff? Or
No, actually the use of malware in certain environments that would tie back to a nation state, specifically Chinese interests, and that watching that evolve. And so with that, I will tell you that it was a little bit of a foreign concept, especially at that period of time in healthcare. So identifying this is about like identifying you know, an alien has arrived outside your home.
Yeah. Okay, so you're starting to see some ominous clouds on the horizon, let us say. So the question becomes, like, how did that then progress to a breach if you could see it coming? I mean, it's what is it like the Titanic heading towards the iceberg and it's too big to change the course? I mean, how did it actually unfold from there?
Well, so I think the biggest thing that I'll share that was a takeaway, certainly for me and my team and those at Anthem, is that at the point that you have somebody who's interested in your organization, especially for purposes of espionage, you have to understand that there will very likely be multiple groups involved, and they may not know about one another. That's one. And I think the other thing that everyone needs to think about, you know, they talk a lot about APT, and I think in many cases we can ignore the advanced nature and spend more time on the P, on the persistence, meaning the longevity and the tirelessness of the attack that you're likely to see. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, having two groups, we were identifying one group when a second group sort of led to the problem that you read about in the news. Mm. So that's I think something that sharing with your listeners, that if they believe they have parties interested for espionage or maybe even just financial gain, that it's likely that there'll be multiple groups involved.
What were the steps that you took when you first identified the, you know, we'll call them Group A? Like, what did you do at that point? Did you reach out to authorities? Did you introduce certain additional detection measures? What was your actual response to that to begin with?
Sure. So at the point that we identified activity, which was not a breach, but certainly the evidence of malware that we didn't want in our environment, that group, which we, funny enough, we called Group, it later became known as Group B.
sorry then to just confuse that. We'll call them Group B. Yeah.
No. You're ahead of the curve. So you know, you're doing things. We shared in the intelligence community. We shared with law enforcement, and we shared most importantly internally, trying to phrase and frame up this new and sort of foreign concept into an organization who really wasn't familiar with the idea of espionage or nation states being involved. So making sure that others knew this, and it was making its way up, you know, action was being taken. But as you know, in large organizations, you know, you, especially larger organizations, are often difficult to defend. And so even if you're aware and sort of understanding, I'll share with what we were doing in healthcare was, speaking of ahead of the curve, was way ahead of the curve in terms of our research and analysis and the talent that we had. Wonderful people like Toby Hendricks and Brian Carter, who you may not know, but are really set the curve in industry. So we had this sort of special forces group, if you will, that was identifying and sort of coaching the environment on how they should react and respond.
So then this other group comes along and they get you. How did they do it? You know, I mean, was it Colonel Mustard in the study with the candlestick holder? Like, you know, what was the actual MO of the successful attackers?
I would love to explain it with that sort of jovial spirit that you shared. I wish it was so kind, but no, what I'll share, you know, some of these elements, what I can share from a technical perspective or from a process perspective, they came through a highly connected subsidiary that was sort of going through an integration process. So they sort of tried the front door and ended up coming through a side door. And in those examples, we all have them in our networks that we may have limited due to integration or due to some sort of a new investment, limited visibility or limited capability as a result of a merger or acquisition. And that's ultimately how it came through. Ultimately, sort of patient zero, I'll share. No surprise to you or your listeners, simple phishing message was sort of the result. But
so it was a phishing exercise against an acquisition that was in the process of being integrated into your network, and perhaps that part of the network wasn't being monitored quite the same as the core Anthem network.
Well, I think that you'll get anytime you buy an organization or merge, everyone has sort of different process, different tool sets, and any other. You know, think of it even just as a marriage. You've got to decide which silverware and cutlery and whatnot you're going to keep or throw out. And that's sort of what you get into. But the caution that I'll give to the listener is whether it's a subsidiary or even it could even be someone you're seeking for legal counsel or third-party supply chain. That's ultimately how the adversary, if they can't get in directly, they'll get in indirectly, which is what we saw in our situation.
Is the name of that organization public? Like, is that something that's been discussed before?
Certainly, yes. And so the organization that I don't know that the name, and I don't know that it's an organization that Anthem owns and fully owns and is fully integrated now. But it's, I guess the lesson I'll share is, or what I'm willing to share is, that if you're going through an M&A, even if you do diligence ahead of time, like a breach assessment, that's fantastic. I highly recommend it. But still know that, as we all know, that if it's a large enough organization, it could be a year before everything's fully integrated. And so I guess my advice is be ruthless in your approach to what you do when you go in and integrate technically. Make it quick. You know, don't fall to sort of the political pressures that can come to you.
Was the issue that the data was with this now fully integrated group, like the data that was stolen from them, or their access to Anthem's data is what was leveraged by the attackers?
The latter. So the access is leveraged. It moves over. Yep. And so many organizations, I'll state, even if they have a mature security program, suffer from the ability to understand or monitor lateral movement within an internal network. So even if they have tools in place, let's say they have NetFlow or maybe they have virtual execution engines and things, they can detect some east and west and some north south. But when credentials are stolen from the outside or especially inside, having a mechanism in place where you can sort of identify, that's another piece of advice I'll say that most folks probably know, but I'll just amplify that a bit. That was an issue for us in understanding, looking back at the breach, something that I would wager that more folks should look into. So context around credentials and where they may be used.
UEBA, which I'm guessing is what attracted you to the job at Exabeam.
Well, yeah. So we were a customer post breach. That's public. And, you know, going through the breach and sort of warning groups of the issue ahead of time, leading technical breach response. I was very involved in the legal elements and then the building or the rebuilding of several programs. And after you have those sort of sets of bookends, looking in and say, okay, who solves these problems was certainly an interest in mine and certainly absolutely led to my involvement in future Exabeam and joining the organization. That's not what today's about necessarily, but certainly aligns with my interests for sure.
Yeah. So how did Anthem actually become aware of this breach?
It was discovered internally, which is sort of my preferred way or that I would hope for most organizations rather than a knock at the door.
Or a post on Risky Biz or, you know, Krebs on security.
Sure. And so there was actually a database administrator. This is, I believe, is public, that identified some a job that had been kicked off that he didn't commit. And so credit to him. And it was escalated to my organization. And I'll quite never forget when, you know, you see strange things in a computing environment. Sometimes it's just bad IT and other times it's a bad day. And the moment where I was standing over a gentleman's shoulder and made the call that this is in fact a bad day. And the world for me was never the same after that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can sort of detect a hint of trauma in your voice as you discuss all of this. So thank you again for agreeing to this interview. I'm curious too, like, you know, we're speaking about this as a Chinese espionage op. Why is it that Chinese security services would be interested in healthcare data from a company like Anthem?
So there's several theories. There's one that's sort of prevailing that I believe in most is they're not interested in the fact that you've had your knee replaced or you've had a problem necessarily in that regard. But if you look across of what's been attacked, where you have, whether it's OPM data, which would be clearance data, travel information, which is who's going where, when, scheduling, airline information, and then sort of the data that an organization in healthcare might have, like Anthem or others, you're beginning to piece together employment history, dependents, so sort of the family tree, and the prevailing thought is that there's a creation of an espionage-enhanced version of Facebook, if you will, for them to identify sort of who's connected to who, where they've worked, and where they're
going. It's big data espionage, basically.
Correct. And my concern or my fear moving forward is that at some point, You know, this data is only good for so long, and the people that are interested in having it will want an update to it at some point. I firmly believe that.
Have we seen any fraud on this data, or has it just sort of disappeared into, you know, SIGIN agencies?
In terms of what we've identified, there's absolutely been no fraud, and that's been sort of validated by several perspectives or from several perspectives, and those that are people that are smarter than I am, for sure. That's not to say that in other espionage or other groups that you might not see that. We've not seen it with the groups that are interested in Anthem or in any other healthcare related to the Chinese issue that's sort of hit us. So that's not to say moving forward that it's not possible, especially as lines are blurred from criminal elements and up from other areas of the world where there's a government criminal sort of relationship that's
maybe when the data gets old enough that it's not useful, they'll kick it out to some, throw it out to some lesser groups as in order to curry favor. I can see that happening.
It's a possibility, but we haven't seen it. I'm more interested and curious to see if there's sort of another couple of rounds of interest in other types of data, or at least an update to the old sort of breach information that they've acquired from other locations, if you will. So do they want to freshen it up, and how do they go about doing that?
Now, look, often the first casualty of any information security incident, large incident, the first casualty, as in war, is the truth. So I'm wondering it must have been frustrating, because I know there was a class action lawsuit which really locks down what people can say. I'm guessing some of the reporting was inaccurate. That's just inevitable. What were the biggest misconceptions that were being peddled out there, do you feel, in the wake of the breach?
Well, yeah, misconception number one, I think, is most, if not all, of what's been written. This is sort of a technicality, but it's one I'll bring up. I can talk about it now. Is that most of the write-ups, see, we shared our indicators from our group B, which is the one that didn't lead to the breach. So sharing those indicators, people are doing sort of link analysis and assessments and putting that out there and sort of making conclusions, these analytic leaps that would be normal in most cases, but are untrue or inaccurate. And so all the assessments that you'll read linking the Anthem adversary to other groups, even OPM, is not directly correct from my perspective and from the perspective of others.
So it was a Chinese APT crew, but not that one.
Exactly. And yeah. So that's one. It's a small one, but it's kind of big.
It'd be enough to give me the shits if I were you.
No, I love that term too, by the way. So it kind of pisses you off a little. And I think that the other one is there's a concept that I have that I like to share is there's the maturity and the efficacy of a program. And I was very proud of this small group that we put together. And I felt like that it aided in the ability for Anthem to respond well, and not only understand these types of issues ahead of the game, but also respond to it in a better way, which we did. But then there's also a concept that sort of collides with that for some organizations. And that's if maybe the company could do better with hygiene, or maybe better executive support, or maybe better or faster organizational actions, or maybe just a faster integration, you know, cleaning up of data centers and such. So I think in many cases we see that, oh, someone's had a breach, and then they sort of get laughed at publicly for not having a good program, or, you know, maybe not responding the way they should. I think we need to hold people accountable, but we need to sort of stop some of the shaming that we see. You see comments on social media and such. I think if we continue to degrade each other, I don't know that we're going to have a greater positive response.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, the usual response in a situation like this is to say, oh my God, someone walked out all of their data. You know, what a bunch of idiots. But usually there's a team in there and they're doing their best, right? And they're not stupid. It's just they can only do so much, right?
That's correct. And everyone who is certainly interested enough in from their career and their knowledge perspective that wants to join in and spend their time listening to a radio show or a podcast, or reading breach reports, or being involved in the community, there's a lot of people that care very much. And I can say from a firsthand perspective that people were, emotionally touched by this. I saw people give all they had physically and mentally and emotionally that worked until they were physically ill on this issue and cared very much about it well before. And so, I have a little bit different perspective than maybe some others. But at the same time, I'll take that team over any other team. The fact they've gone through this problem and called the shot ahead of time, went through it, did an amazing job on the response. Those are the people that I want to hire moving forward versus ones that maybe they're skilled, maybe they're fantastic, maybe they've prevented 100 breaches, but they still don't know the pain associated, the real story of how this stuff goes down because they've not felt it yet.
Battle-hardened people. Makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
So another question would be, I mean, this is the obvious question that I've saved till last. You know, what would you have done differently? What would you have done to stop this? Can you think of some measures that you could have introduced that would have stopped this?
Okay, so I'll put them in two buckets. There's sort of technical, tactical buckets, and then there's sort of process or what I'll refer to as sort of team religion and mindset. Technical elements, you need visibility. You've got to be able to see your network, and you've got to be able to then make decisions based on that. So having better centralized logging into areas and being able to see, even more information. You need to also eliminate anything, especially externally, but also internally. You know, you're looking at adaptive authentication technologies. Avoid any type of single factor, username, password, which is its basic fundamental thing. So you need to see it. You need to be able to limit the misuse of stolen credentials. And you've got to make sense of that. Once an internal adversary is inside, you got to be able to tell where they go. From a process perspective, really go through and evaluate what is your IR plan and does it actually make any sense? Most organizations I talk to, or after I get digging in a bit, they have an IR plan, but it doesn't represent sort of the scope or the breadth or the amount of pain that they're likely to feel if they have a breach. It has to represent reality. You've got to train like you fight, and there's a gap there in most all organizations. We got to fix that. Mm. Some of the things I think I did that the team did and me, we made process a priority before the breach. So even a small team of 6-7 people. We worked for months and months and months documenting our processes, and not because an auditor told us to. We wanted just to be better and faster. So when we identified the problem, you can even see in the papers and the response that we had. I believe it started there. And I'll also credit our executives. Our CEO Joe Swedish took ownership like I've never seen before, and he owned it and pushed forward. So we had his support. We had great process. We made communications a priority. There's a lot of great things. It's a lot of technical things I wish were different, but a lot of procedural and sort of team spirit and process that were great.
So I've got to ask, though, who do we blame for this? I mean, if you are to apportion blame, aside from the attackers, of course, who are primarily responsible, was this a case of management not being aware of the risks? Was it a case of management hindering the security people from being able to, sound the alarm with regard to certain risks? Whose fault was this?
Tough question, but I love it. I guess the first piece, I'll start with me. Ultimately, I was in charge of having a group of a small group of people to identify bad things like this. And ultimately it's my responsibility to go through and do whatever I can to influence the environment, to make different decisions and to modify the environment in a way that should harden it up. In lieu of that, which is what we did, we shared our recommendations up. You have to also know that in the organization, large organizations are often slow to change, even under strange circumstance, like have an alien show up. So traction was being made, but I think people were still some were skeptical of an espionage adversary. Is it real? Is it really there? Do we need to really make some of these changes? And so, I can tell you that Joe, there was others in the organization that were going to publicly sort of own the failure and sort of be the name of the breach. And he owned it. He said, no, I'm in charge. This is my watch. And so he publicly took it. And so I guess at that point, he chose to own it in a much larger way than I just said that, blame me. I'm hesitant, even though I'm not a part of the organization, there's a lot of people there that I still respect and love, and I'm hesitant to put any sort of other blame on others. We often see it, though. When breaches happen, people get fired. I think
everything you're saying sort of seems, I can tie it back to one thing, which is you're saying if we knew then what we know now, maybe this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I think that's
and I'm not talking about from a technical point of view. I'm talking about it from a taking the risk seriously point of view.
You are completely correct. If you go enough nights without sleep, and you take that that stress and that pain to far-reaching areas of a company, and you cost, you know, you expend the dollars and that we had to for the breach, everybody has a clearer idea of what it really means. The sad part is it takes a catastrophic event in order to have the education required, at least at that point, from my perspective. You know, people hear, oh, we're going to have an issue, but until they really feel that pain, I don't know that that people truly take it as seriously as they could, even some security teams, frankly.
Well, Stephen Moore, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's our last feature of the year, and I think it's a perfect cautionary tale to end the year on. And it's so great that you yourself are willing to come onto the show and speak about something which, you know, could be perceived as a failure. But really, you know, it's great to dive in and talk about the nuance of the whole thing, talk about how it went down. And I have a feeling that there will be some CISOs and other security people listening to this who will be feeling a little bit cold and sweaty after this interview. So I really do appreciate you talking to us about this on the show. Stephen Moore.
Thank you. Flattered to be here. Appreciate the time.
That was Stephen Moore, formerly of Anthem, there with a look inside the Anthem breach. Big thanks to him for that. I'd also like to thank the Exabeam crew for putting me in touch with him too and letting him talk about this this stuff. And I think, you know, as I said earlier, I think there's a whole bunch of lessons in that one for a lot of people. Okay, so it's on to this week's sponsor interview now with Casey Ellis, the founder and CTO of BugCrowd, the managed bug bounty program provider. When Uber announced that it had been breached and then subsequently paid a ransom to an attacker so he'd delete what he stole, it caused a fairly substantial outrage in the majors. But one thing that complicated the reaction to all of that is that a lot of the coverage really drove home the point that the attacker was paid via a bug bounty platform. That data point sort of wound up conflating extortion with legit bounty programs, much to the annoyance of everyone in that industry. HackerOne, Uber's provider, did catch a lot of flack when it was revealed on this podcast that the company had facilitated the payment to the attacker via Bitcoin as a payment method. But what should HackerOne have done when they figured out what Uber was doing? I mean, the company wasn't actually managing that program. They were just offering their platform to Uber. But it is possible and kind of likely that they knew this was happening. Now, if they did know, should they have just stopped the payment going through? Should they have snitched on a big customer to a regulator? I guess what I'm asking here is the shit sandwich that HackerOne has been eating in the press over the last few weeks justified? Well, as you'll hear, Casey Ellis of BugCrowd, which is a Risky Business sponsor, he is a HackerOne competitor, but he's not so keen to completely bucket them on this. He thinks it's complicated. Here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different ways to look at it. I think, you know, HackerOne have pretty clearly position themselves in response to other things that have happened in the past as a pure platform play that kind of, you know, stands at arm's length to any kind of weird stuff that's happening underneath it. So, you know, to that extent, I do think that it might be a little bit unfair to throw shade at them around all of this. I mean,
yeah, I think a lot of people might not realize that in this case, they weren't providing a bug bounty service to Uber. They were just hosting it. Sort of thing, right? And it was Uber people who actually processed the payment, not HackerOne staff. That said, you know, you'd assume that they knew what was happening.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you can only speculate on that. So I think the thing there is that, you know, fine, if they did know and they didn't try to stop it from happening, that's probably not cool, just because of the impact that it has on the overall industry going forward.
But what are they supposed to do? Like, snitch on a huge client, right? Like, I sort of feel like I'm a little bit sympathetic, because if you are them, or, you know, if it was you, you know, what do you sort of do in that situation? I mean, is it your call to make to start snitching to regulators? That's not going to be good for business.
No, for sure. But also, I think, you know, in terms of the approach that we've taken, the way that we think about this, is that we're stewarding the growth of a new market, right? So making sure that things that could threaten it at scale are avoided is really part of our job responsibility. So it's one of those things where there's no, I think, simple answer that's pat that we can just run forward with. But, you know, that is something that I'd kind of inject into that thinking.
Now, it seems like a lot of this reporting has been conflating this issue of, a blackmail breach with bug bounty programs, which, and, you know, you read the stories and they're not really saying that, you know, this was something that occurred inside a bug bounty program. But the fact that they're mentioned at all, I'd imagine, is not something that you would really appreciate reading.
No, that's accurate.
So what's the reaction been like from the market so far? I mean, has there been a bit of confusion?
Yeah, there has been. I think that, you know, the opportunity that confusion's given us is to explain the difference between a bug bounty and extortion. the whole concept of a bug bounty and responsible disclosure and this whole trend is really for organizations to become, you know, proactive in their invitation to people that have this kind of ability to give them information and help them become safer as a result. And off the back of that conversation, there's a reward that's on offer if it's a bug bounty program, right? The difference between that and extortion is that, you know, in the case of extortion, it all starts with the person who's trying to do the extorting, and the whole, you know, conversation happens far more reactively. That to me is a fairly clear distinction between the two. It's something that's initiated by the vendor as opposed to something that's initiated by an aggressor out there on the internet.
Now, that makes perfect sense. But I want to dive into some of the gray areas here because they are many. There are many gray areas here. Yep. And I can recall, Casey, having conversations with you where a client was approached by someone, you know, not even a client, a company was approached by someone saying, hey, we found these vulnerabilities in your apps or your infrastructure or whatever, give us money. And that client, that company, has then gone to you and asked you to sort of help them out through that situation. I believe that often cases involved in registering that person on the platform and giving them a payment. The distinction here is there's no breached data, but it's a very similar scenario, isn't it? That's why I mentioned that it's a gray area.
Yeah, no, for sure. And in the cases where, like, there's been, like, less than a full handful, I would say, of those in BugCrowd's history, but they have happened, and we've talked about them publicly in the past. What we've done is to make sure that, you know, we've diffused the imbalance of power that's kind of natural to the kickoff of these sorts of conversations between an extorter and you know, someone who's being extorted, and try to resolve it safely, but also make sure that, you know, laws are being obeyed and all of the norms and things are being done properly, you know, as that progresses, right? So that's what we've seen in the past. I think,
but surely there would have been some CFAA violations in those instances that weren't reported, right?
Yeah, definitely. Mm. Absolutely. I mean, as there is, I think, in terms of, you know, this whole idea of vulnerability disclosure being normalized and people just going out and hacking everything despite there not being an invitation, like, that's in violation of CFAA as well. So there's a whole bunch of gray space that's really in progress of being kind of settled out in this area as we go along. But I think the thing that, you know, really, you know, comes to mind for me with this whole conversation around Uber is, you know, on one end of the spectrum, as a bug bounty hunter, you don't want to just produce alert one or some sort of, you know, shitty, like, not very effective at communicating impact POC around the vulnerabilities you find. Right, so there is a responsibility or a, you know, an incentive for bug bounty hunters to actually demonstrate impact when they're finding things, but there's some sort of logical line between doing that effectively and, you know, exfiltrating 57 million records from a free bucket. Yeah. And the thing that's interesting at the moment is that there's no real clear definition of where that line actually exists. So
that's exactly right. And I mean, I'm thinking back to a case that you would almost certainly remember from here in Australia, where a friend of the show, Patrick Webster, did a post auth direct object ref by accident, I think. And one of, you know, someone else's, you know, pension or superannuation statement came up. So he wrote a script, went and made a cup of tea, and that, you know, hosed a bunch of data. Then he reported it to them, not seeking a reward, just saying, hey, you know, this is a problem. And then he had the police on his doorstep. In that case, I was very much on his side, even though he had exfiltrated user data.
Yeah, and this is the thing, is that, like, it goes down to intent, which, you know, is pretty blurry when you start to apply it at scale, like actually identifying what that intent was and actually differentiating that intent between the intent of an actual malicious actor. Like, that's pretty hard to do when you start to scale this whole thing up, right? So one of the things that we're doing is we're starting to actually work with OWASP around basically open sourcing and generating consensus around where those lines exist. Because
I think
so,
you know, case specific though, man, that is going to be hard. I mean, good for you for tackling that, but I don't think you could ever come up with a guide that is going to fully nail this down, which is in a US point of view. I mean, everyone's so process oriented in the United States that's
100%. And you know, I expect this to become very much a conversation and a living document as opposed to, yeah, you know, 3 records is okay, 10 is bad or whatever. But, you know, the thing that I think is coming into the picture, has been in the picture for a while in the US, but it's starting to come into the picture in Australia and elsewhere as well, is this whole idea of mandatory breach notification and some of the legal impacts of not doing this well on the customer side. And that starts to affect how people, you know, structure their programs and do things in the future. So, you know, none of these questions, I think, are unanswerable or insurmountable, because ultimately, you know, organizations need better help to get hacker feedback to figure out how to reduce their risk, right?
So I'd imagine, though, that law that you just briefly touched on there that proposes jail time for executives who sweep breaches under the rugs, I mean, that can't be good for the bug bounty business, because you're going to expect that in some programs people are going to go outside of the rules and maybe download some PII. But, I mean, what can ameliorate that is the fact that there's an NDA in place with a lot of bug bounty participants. Does that cover that off?
Yeah, the NDA definitely does. And I think at a broader scale, as it relates to the more public programs, you know, just understanding what the difference is between exploiting a company and actually pointing out a problem looks like, and where you can like parameterize that. And to your point, that's going to be very, very difficult to define succinctly and maintain. But I think the whole idea of having that conversation and making sure that that's something that people are thinking about as they decide which is which on the receiving end, and on the hacker side of things as well, that's an important thing to start to talk about at this juncture of it all.
It's my personal view that Uber didn't do the right thing in this instance. They should have at least called the regulator and actually told them what they've done. And it's my feeling that the regulator may not have even forced them to go public with that. Like, I don't know. Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't have, but they should have taken that chance. They should have rolled the dice. I guess, though, there's a key difference, and we spoke about this in the news section a couple of weeks ago. The key difference between what happened in this instance and someone going out of scope in a bounty, it really does come down to that relationship between the tester and the organization being tested. It comes down to that relationship having been well-defined, in place, under NDA, up, right?
Yeah, it's the golden rule of bug bounties is you need to align expectation before you kick things off. And then you need to maintain the commitments that you make on both sides of the equation. I think with Uber, you know, I completely agree. Like, you know, the fact that the FBI and some of the folk on this side of the pond go out and tell people to pay the ransom when they're hit by ransomware, the whole idea of using money to mitigate risk in an extortion scenario, that's not by nature illegal. It looks shady, but it's not illegal in that sense, right? But then going on and you know, not disclosing that breach, you know, in spite of data breach regulations and some of the other things that you know, kind of legally caught up the Uber team on this one, that's definitely a clear no-no.
Yep. Now, while we've got you here, I want to move on to another topic, which is the DJI bug bounty. I mean, this has been a slow burn disaster for like the last month. We finally spoke about it in the news section in last week's show. But I see, just looking at Twitter this morning, we are recording this on Friday, December 8th here in Australia. You know, I can see Kevin Finisterre is now getting DMCA takedown notices for like repos that he's forked that contained mistakes made by DJI staff. And it's just, you know, this is a disaster that is still unfolding. What did you make of all of this? Because it seems like they really did, you know, if you want an example of how not to run a bounty program, this seems like a pretty good one.
Yeah, and to be honest, like this is what I've been saying to folk that have asked me the same question. Like the DJI, you know, conversation between Kevin and some other folk in the hunting community is pretty much a gold standard of all of the things that you shouldn't do. It's like literally a laundry list of just simple, common, easy to avoid mistakes that companies make when they jump into this without, you know, either thinking it through or I think more specifically getting expert input on how to plan and how to implement this sort of thing well.
Well, Casey Ellis, that is our final sponsor interview for the 2017 season of Risky Business. The final interview, in fact, for the 2017 Risky Business season. Thank you very much for all of your contributions over the year and, of course, for Bug Crowd's sponsorship of the show. We do appreciate it, and we'll be chatting to you again next year.
It's a privilege, Pat. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
That was Casey Ellis of Bug Crowd there. Big thanks to Bug Crowd for its sponsorship of the Risky Business podcast over the years. And of course, they are back on board next year. And I do really enjoy having these conversations with Casey. So I'm thrilled that they'll be joining us again in 2018. So yeah, that's that. Now, before I wrap up for the year, I just want to be a bit indulgent and say a few things. As many of you would know, over the last 2 years, I've been putting a lot of work into the business side of Risky Biz. And you know what? It's actually a real business now. After a lot of work, we've got things to exactly where we set out to get them. We are exactly where we want to be. And that transformation really, really accelerated when I hired Tiran Ferrier here on the North Coast to work as the Risky Business Commercial Manager. So Tiran, thank you very much for all of the hard work you've put in. Hiring you was one of the best decisions I've ever made. So really, thank you. To Jules Reed, thanks for enduring the trauma of setting up proper accounting systems for us and dealing with the old multi-currency hell. You are a legend. Thanks to Gold at Evolve Development for developing us a killer new static website with a very custom back end. It's made my life so much easier, and I do sleep better now that we're only hosting static content. That's great. And I also want to say thanks to the audience as well. It's really humbling that something like 20,000 of you tune in every week. And, you know, I like to think I know my audience, and you're not dummies. You're very smart people. And the fact that you choose to get information from this program, as I say, it is really humbling. Lastly, of course, I want to thank my colleague in this venture, Adam Boileau of Insomnia Security. His regular co-hosting of this program's news segment is a cornerstone of its success. My friend, I owe a huge chunk of our recent success to you, and I won't forget it, and neither should you. And of course, thanks to the sponsors. This show does not float without them, and by and large, we've got a pretty good bunch. We have something like 30-plus sponsors on board next year, even an AV company. I let an AV company sponsor a soapbox because they're sick of me trash-talking them, and they want to tell you all that they're actually doing good stuff these days. So, hey, least I can do is hear them out. And yeah, I guess, you know, that's one thing, right? More and more, I'm opening this business up to be a little bit more industry-focused. I'm trying to do it as cleanly, transparently, and honestly as possible. And I'll be doing it without the new stuff affecting the weekly show. I'm going to do my best. It won't always be good enough. Sometimes you'll hear a sponsor interview and you'll think, geez, those guys are a bit, you know, whatever. But I promise you, I'm going to do my best to get interesting vendors on. And actually still, even though they're paying to be on the show, I'm still going to try to ask them real questions that people want to know the answers to. And, you know, you've got to keep in mind too, sometimes I don't even know until after I've interviewed them, like whether they're going to be interesting, right? So you've got to keep that in mind and, you know, just let's keep that in mind into the future. The Soapbox and the Snake Oil podcasts are a roaring success, by the way. And if things keep going like this, I will be hiring a producer and an alternate host who can fill in for me on my vacation weeks. And don't worry, they will be good. I will be working very hard to make sure that if anyone else sits in this chair, they're gonna deliver. But I guess that's it for this, the 11th season of Risky Business. And again, you know, just thank you so much to the audience. Without you, I don't have this job. And to me, it is the best job on the planet. It's as simple as that. I hope you all have a great time in the weeks while I'm away. I hope you all get some time off too. And yeah, bring on 2018. Until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.